I probably picked it up at the airport, where I was in contact with a lot of people coming in from overseas. I started to feel next day completely exhausted. I started to have a headache and a sore throat, aching all over, and had a fever at about 101. And the doctors told me this was the Asiatic flu.
That was one of the more than 10 million victims of Asiatic or Asian flu, a new form of influenza. With the approach of winter, American medical authorities are concerned with building defenses against the threat of an Asian flu epidemic. All over the United States, people are talking about the microscopic virus which has traveled invisibly across the world, and they are raising questions like these.
What is the difference between Asian flu and ordinary flu?
I'd like to know where the Asian flu started.
What are the initial symptoms?
Do you think everybody should get injected for it?
Has age anything to do with whether it will have any harmful effect on you or not?
Is it fatal?
Would it leave you with a heart condition?
It will affect your hearing.
How long would it last for the individual patient?
I would like to know how the vaccine is going to be allocated in my community.
With this here time, the flu is worse than it was in 1918.
What would be a simple first aid remedy if you thought a member of your family had it?
In the interests of helping to answer these and other questions, CBS Radio now presents a comprehensive documentary about Asian flu and the defense against it. In this recorded report, you will hear prominent health officials, laboratory scientists, practicing physicians, and overseas correspondents telling how the Asian flu started, how it has affected other parts of the world, how it is expected to affect the United States, and what you can do about it. The narrator for this special report is CBS News correspondent Walter Cronkite.
For almost 7 months now, Americans have been hearing and reading about Asian influenza. Never before in history has a disease been so widely heralded in the headlines so long before its arrival in strength. The infinitesimal flu virus has won such notoriety that it has even been the inspiration for a popular song, rock and roll, no less.
I got a rockin' pneumonia and a boogie-woogie flu. Yeah!
Now on the verge of colder weather, the American medical profession faces the challenge of how to deal with the threat of an Asian flu epidemic. An epidemic which already has swept across most of the world. The man who bears the chief responsibility for preparing this nation against Asian flu is Dr. Leroy Birney, Surgeon General of the United States. Dr. Birney remembers how his office had its first inkling that a major health problem was in the offing.
Our first report came from the World Health Organization Regional Center in the Western Pacific regarding the large outbreak in Hong Kong. Following that, we received continuing reports of the spread of this epidemic to the Philippines and Indonesia, and then in the other direction to India and Pakistan. It was about the middle of April that we received those reports.
Hong Kong had been pinpointed as the probable source of the Asian flu outbreak. CBS News correspondent Guy Searles gives this on-the-scene version of the origin of what was soon to become a universal headache.
An ancient Chinese festival has been blamed by local residents here in Hong Kong for the spread of Asian influenza to the free world. Last April, the old Chinese Qingming Festival took place, a festival which is sort of an Oriental version of American Memorial Day. Thousands of Chinese from Hong Kong went back to various places on the Red China mainland to pay respects at the graves of their ancestors. Many of them came back to Hong Kong infected by the influenza which had been sweeping the mainland. By the second and third weeks of April, the influenza had reached epidemic proportions in Hong Kong, and close to 300,000 persons were believed to have been affected. So many people became ill that public transportation and a number of other services had to be curtailed to some extent. Many offices almost quit functioning because of so many influenza absentees.
Within a few weeks, the Asian flu virus was spreading rapidly. The mounting number of local outbreaks was noted by the World Health Organization, whose chief of international quarantine is Dr. Robert Hood.
We received word from Singapore that an extensive outbreak of influenza had broken out in that city and was affecting about 10% of the population. That Friday, the information from Singapore was published in the WHO Geneva Weekly Epidemiological Record and distributed to all health administrations, port and airport health officers, and many others interested in the international spread of disease. 3 months later, this weekly publication stated that the Asian influenza pandemic had spread to all continents.
Japan was one of the first countries to be hit. CBS News correspondent Peter Kalischer reports from Tokyo on the consequences in that country.
There were more than 200,000 cases of Asiatic flu in Japan between February and June of this year, causing 549 deaths. There are no reliable figures on how many persons throughout Asia were laid low by the disease. A safe estimate would be in the millions, with the death incidence highest in the more backward and poverty-stricken areas. It spread to Japan too quickly for vaccines to be manufactured and administered in time. But by the middle of June, when the epidemic was easing off, Japanese laboratories were turning out what is now called Tokyo 57 vaccines, crossed with the conventional A and B virus strains.
Meanwhile, American health authorities were seeking a safeguard against the flu virus. At Walter Reed Hospital in Washington, D.C., Dr. Maurice Hilleman needed a specimen of the troublemaking organism.
The first word we had of influenza in the Far East was in a short news item which appeared in the New York Times on April 17th of this year. This article reported that 250,000 cases of influenza had occurred among the 2.5 million persons in Hong Kong. Cables were sent to the Army's 406th Medical General Laboratory in Zama, Japan, asking that they investigate this outbreak in Hong Kong and attempt to recover the virus.
Dr. Hilleman's request was received in Zama, Japan, by Colonel Millard Bayless.
The U.S. Army 406th Medical General Laboratory sent an Army doctor to Hong Kong to collect throat washings. He was Lieutenant Colonel Charles Krall, our epidemiologist. From the specimens he brought back, and others from Japan, Formosa, and the Philippines, the lab isolated what we thought was a new type of influenza virus, a variant of what is known as type A. This virus, more throat washings, and blood sera from patients were sent to Walter Reed, Army Institute of Research in Washington, D.C.
At Walter Reed, Dr. Hilleman and his co-workers now made their significant discovery.
On May the 22nd, we had our answer and were able to report the occurrence of a new influenza virus in the Far East, which belonged to type A. These findings suggested the great potential importance of the virus, and we took action to get the wheels rolling. This consisted of advising the United States Armed Forces Epidemiological Board, the World Health Organization, the United States Public Health Service, and also the 6 licensed influenza vaccine manufacturers of the existence of this new virus and of our appraisal of its importance.
By now, Asian flu had appeared sporadically in Europe. It was blamed for an outbreak of flu at the United States Air Force Base at Burtonwood, England. The chief medical officer there is Colonel Joseph Baird.
We have had approximately 600 airmen throughout the United Kingdom that have been affected. We have noticed a steady decline in the number of new cases. There has been a very little loss of time. No one has been really seriously ill, and well, they've all got back in less than a week.
CBS News correspondent Alexander Kendrick, reporting from London, provides examples of how Europe reacted to its Asian flu epidemic.
The virus, officially called A-Singapore-1-57, and popularly known as Far Eastern or Asian flu, has now arrived in most European countries. Its medical impact thus far can be described as inconsiderable. So far, Asian flu, if indeed it has been Asian flu, for even that is not clearly established, has been confined to several so-called closed communities. For example, the recent Boy Scout Jamboree in Britain and the Communist Youth Festival in Moscow listed as sources of contagion. Health researchers have found some 80-year-old people in Holland with antibodies or natural immunity to the present Asian virus. And this makes scientists suspect that the present outbreak may be related to a previous pandemic of Asian flu in 1890 and 91. So the current epidemic is regarded as just another cycle in the 2,000-year-old mystery-enwrapped history of influenza.
In its onward sweep, the epidemic was spanning oceans. It erupted in South America, and the effect is reported by CBS News correspondent Peter Hahn from Buenos Aires.
There is a new greeting in South America. It goes, "Have you two got the flu?" This continent is wheezing and coughing under a siege of Asian influenza, which has no equal in recent Latin American history. Literally millions are bedridden with the novel disease, and thousands died of pulmonary complications brought on by the sickness. The Chilean capital of Santiago has been virtually paralyzed during the past few weeks. Banks and shops had to close down as 1 million of the city's 2 million inhabitants were stricken. 3,000 deaths in Chile were attributed to the virus. Argentina, too, feels the impact of the disease. Absenteeism from industrial establishments here has dropped back to an almost normal 10% after hitting a peak of almost 50% 3 weeks ago. Daily disinfection of downtown areas in Buenos Aires continues. But health experts believe that the epidemic has passed its peak in this part of the world.
In the United States, the Public Health Service was intently tracking the epidemic's course, and Surgeon General Leroy Birney had already launched a defensive program.
We called together representatives of some of the outside groups, such as Armed Forces Epidemiologic Board, the Commission on Influenza, the American Medical Association, the state and territorial health officers and professional groups, to alert them as to what the present situation was and to secure from them advice on what we might do. Then we worked with the manufacturers, urging them, with their full acquiescence, to speed up the amount of vaccine produced to about 60 to 80 million cc. In addition, we have worked with the American Medical Association and the American Hospital Association in preparing plans for mobilization of health resources to take care of those who become sick, because we feel that with a possibility of a high attack rate, hospitals and other health resources will be severely taxed to take care of it.
The question raised now is this: what will the Asian flu do to the United States? Many factors are involved, of course, and there is no strict analogy between the effect produced in other areas and the probable impact on us. Weighing these factors, Dr. Palmer Deering, acting Surgeon General, gives this estimate.
It is possible that 10 to 20% of the people of the United States could eventually become ill with Asian influenza. The great bulk of these cases probably would not be severe. The men, women, and children involved would feel miserably sick, high fever, headache, aching muscles. But their illness would last only a few days, and all present evidence indicates would have few complications. However, there is a community hazard. So many could be sick at one time that physicians, nurses, and hospitals would be overtaxed and many community activities slowed down or even temporarily stopped.
The Surgeon General and other authorities have said that the only preventative to Asian flu is the vaccine. This is a machine in a laboratory where vials of Asian flu vaccine are being capped and turned off the production line. Six pharmaceutical firms have been licensed by the government to produce these precious vials. The firms were chosen because of their past experience in making vaccine for the older forms of flu. In each of the laboratories, there is a speed-up program, a race against time to turn out the chief weapon against Asian flu, vaccines. At Lederle Laboratories, Pearl River, New York, Dr. Irvin Danielson told our reporter how his firm got started on this special job.
On June 12th, we were instructed that probably an epidemic would occur this fall and asked to consider production of this vaccine. Toward the latter part of July, the first batches were completed, and the first material was released in mid-August. We're approaching maximum production at the present time.
The vaccine is grown by injecting the flu virus into fertile eggs. Inside the Lederle Virus Research Laboratory, Stuart Aston tells us how it's done.
We are getting ready to drill a small hole in the air sac end of the egg. Now the operator is getting ready to start her dental drill, and the eggs will be drilled just through the shell, but not through the shell membrane. At this step, the inoculating personnel take the trays of eggs into the inoculation booth. Then a small amount of diluted influenza virus is introduced into each egg. After this step, the opening in the shell is sealed with a collodion ether solution. We could expect between 4 to 6 doses per egg. And then they are incubated at about 35 degrees centigrade.
Later, technicians extract the grown virus from the egg, kill it with formalin, then purify and concentrate it for vaccine. We asked Dr. Danielson how long it takes to produce the vaccine.
The actual growth of the flu virus in the egg embryo is only 2 days. However, the process extends over a period of about 6 to 8 weeks total.
And how much does Letterly plan to produce?
With our program progressing as it is, reaching maximum capacity, we expect to turn out roughly 1 million doses per week by the end of September.
This laboratory at Eli Lilly and Company in Indianapolis uses an egg inoculating machine, which injects flu virus into 6 eggs at a time.
An inoculation, another batch of eggs. An inoculation, and another 6 eggs.
Being able to inoculate 6 eggs at a time with this machine, how many doses will Eli Lilly produce? John McClain.
It is our hope that by the 1st of October, we will be producing at least 1 million doses of vaccine per week.
Despite the rush to turn out Asian flu vaccine, it is obvious that there cannot be enough for everyone by the height of the cold season. A system of allocation has already been worked out. Harry McNay of Letterly Laboratories explains how the vaccine will be distributed.
We will distribute it on a basis of population by state. The production that we had for the first 2 weeks has been distributed almost 100% to hospitals. Next, we plan to distribute it to physicians for use on patients that are engaged in essential industry. Heavy use of vaccine by the military has made civilian allocation necessary. We have been swamped with orders from druggists and physicians. In order to spread the vaccine as far as possible, we have limited the shipment of vaccine at this time to 5 vials per doctor. Each vial is 10 doses. This means that each doctor will be able to immunize 50 patients.
A question asked repeatedly is, what could happen to my community in the event that Asian flu should strike it in epidemic proportions? We have asked Dr. Morris Greenberg, director of the Bureau of Preventable Diseases in New York City, to envisage the effect on America's largest city if it were hit by a hypothetical epidemic.
If it hits New York, it may attack a certain percentage of the population. We don't know whether that percentage will be 1 or 5 or 10%. It will probably run fairly rapidly through the population. The only concern is that a considerable percentage of people may be hit at the same time, so that if they are workers in essential industries, it may in some way cripple that industry.
Communities will themselves decide how to use the vaccine, but in general it will be used initially to protect workers in certain essential services. These are the people who, simply by going about their daily routines, keep cities, villages, and industrial life humming in an unbroken rhythm. They are the people who would be most sorely missed if they were not there. They include, for example, transportation workers, the men and women who keep the airlines going, the pilots, the ground control crews, and their colleagues.
Descending VFR. Changing over the Los Angeles altimeter 2992. Change to the Los Angeles tower 119.9.
Nurses.
Doctor, Mrs. Brown says Johnny is doing better.
Doctors.
All right, open your mouth and say ah.
Ah.
Elevator operators.
Floor 3, step to the rear of the car.
Communications workers like telephone operators.
Ready with your call to Buffalo.
Those who run trains and subways.
All right, watch the door. Step inside. All right, let's go.
And the buses.
Pull back in the bus.
The civil services, policemen.
306 to Central, okay?
Go ahead, 306.
306.
And all the others who maintain our hospitals, our prisons, our utility plants. It includes our firemen, our longshoremen, and others who vary from one community to another. It includes the people whose presence we take for granted, but who keep our cities running full speed like this. Assume for a moment that most of these workers were home in bed at the same time, even if the cause were a mild ailment. Imagine how your city would run. The result, as one might imagine it, would be this slowdown. It is to prevent this that communities allocate the limited supplies of the vaccine to those essential services. A task undertaken by the American Medical Association is the dissipation of fear inspired by incorrect information. The AMA is sponsoring a public education program directed by an influenza committee. Its head is Dr. Harold Luth.
The American Medical Association feels it is extremely important that the public know what to expect and what to do about Asian influenza. They should know, for instance, that the flu itself is not too serious, that the illness is of short duration, generally mild with few complications. Most of the fears expressed by people are quite foundless. Except in unusual cases, the virus will not precipitate a heart condition. It will not affect the hearing, nor affect other organs. It will not result in a chronic condition of any kind. Once you've had the Asian flu, you develop an immunity to that particular virus strain and won't get it again.
Dr. Luth deals with the question that concerns everyone. What can the individual do if he catches Asian influenza?
As a representative of the nation's practicing physicians, I'd like to give you this advice on the treatment of Asian flu. Ideally, your doctor should be called and his instructions followed. However, once an epidemic hits, he may not be able to give you his prompt and undivided attention. In that event, these are the things to remember. First, keep away from others. Second, go to bed. Third, drink lots of fluids such as water and fruit juices. Fourth, take a simple fever-reducing agent as recommended by your physician. And fifth, be sure to call your doctor if any unusual symptoms develop. Symptoms like a heavy cough, rapid breathing, or blueness of the lips that might indicate a complicating illness.
Dr. Yates Trotter of the Epidemic Intelligence Service of the United States answers a question that puzzles many. Just what is the difference between Asian flu and ordinary flu?
The major differences are in the laboratory. The way these differences affect the average person is there is no immunity to Asian flu conferred by the older types of influenza vaccine. So a person who's previously had influenza is not immune to Asian influenza.
The catastrophic flu epidemic of 1918-1919 lingers in the memories of a great many people. Is there a difference between that epidemic and the threatened epidemic of Asian flu? Here is the reply of Dr. Morris Greenberg, director of the Bureau of Preventable Diseases of New York City.
The 1918-1919 epidemic of influenza was unique in the history of influenza. We have pretty good records of influenza outbreaks since about 1500 all over the world. No epidemic prior to 1918-1919, and no epidemic since, and we've had a number of them, has ever had the seriousness of that epidemic. And it was altogether different from the other types of epidemics of influenza that we've had.
The question of general immunization through the use of the flu vaccine is not one on which there is universal agreement. Dr. Herman Bundesen, president of the Chicago Board of Health.
We urge that everyone, as soon as vaccine is available, that they do take the inoculations. The one thing we would like to stress is don't wait. Don't stall around. Get the vaccine. Go to your doctor at once and get it before flu strikes. And then, in all probability, it will not strike you.
Dr. Morris Greenberg offers his opinion.
I would not advise the use of vaccine for the general population. It's a little bit difficult to see why one should try to protect the entire population against an illness which is so mild, particularly since the vaccine frequently causes reactions. Now, while those reactions may not be very severe in adults, in children, and particularly in infants, the reactions may be severe. We have had reports from doctors of temperatures running up to 105 and lasting for a day or two in very small infants. We've also had reports of convulsions in some very young infants when they got the vaccine. And they got very, very small doses, about a tenth of the recommended dose. It's a little bit difficult to see from the point of view of a doctor why one should subject an infant to the possibility of getting these reactions in order to protect them against an illness which is rather mild.
We have asked Dr. Edward C. Kernan of the American Academy of Pediatrics whether he, as a child health specialist, considers the Asian flu vaccine safe for children.
The vaccine may be given to children under a year. This may be initiated as early as 3 months of age when other vaccination procedures are started. Ordinarily, children receiving the vaccine may have a fever, may complain of headache and other discomfort for a period of 12 to 24 hours after the injection. Usually these reactions are not severe or dangerous. As far as we know, both children and adults are susceptible to infection by this form of influenza virus.
Are there circumstances where the vaccination is definitely not advisable?
Those people who are known to be sensitive to egg or to react adversely to eating eggs may have dangerous reactions. These are people who presumably are allergic to egg material, which is contained in the vaccine, and vaccination of such individuals should be avoided.
To obtain an overall view of the Asian flu situation in the country, we shall hear late reports from the health commissioners in various American cities. First, from San Francisco, Dr. Ellis Sox, chief health officer for that city.
In San Francisco, we haven't had a considerably marked increase in the number of cases of influenza reported. The California Conference of Health Officers has recommended that as vaccine becomes available, it be used first for people who work in hospitals and who work in certain critical services, whether they're governmental or private industry. The second priority group are those whose physicians feel that even a mild attack of influenza might be harmful to the person's general health. As the vaccine becomes available, we'll use it as intelligently as we can in the hope that we can reduce deaths and that we can prevent critical industries and activities from becoming crippled or decreased.
Dr. Walter Gardiner, Director of Health, reports on the situation in New Orleans.
In the city of New Orleans, there has been the usual seasonal increase in the number of upper respiratory infections, presenting a symptom comparable to that of Asian flu. A program has been developed in cooperation with the hospitals in this community and is a joint program of organized medicine, civil defense, and American Red Cross, with the affiliated ambulance services of this community being made available and will be used should an emergency arise. A slogan for this impending national disaster adopted in this community is, "Don't become hysterical. Contact your family physician."
The national situation with regard to a threatened epidemic of Asian flu is summarized by Dr. Palmer Deering, Acting Surgeon General.
Tonight, the United States stands in reasonable readiness. We estimate that there have now been more than 100,000 Asian influenza cases in the United States. Outbreaks so far have been sporadic, but they are increasing. The real wave of contagion that has marked other epidemics has not appeared. The manufacturers report that the supply of vaccine is increasing. They tell us that they hope to produce 85 million doses by January 1. On the basis of our experience with earlier influenza vaccines, this new vaccine should be approximately 70% effective. There is reason to be alert. There is little to be alarmed.
It is hoped that an epidemic will not occur in this country. But if one does, we will want to be prepared. We have asked the Surgeon General of the United States, Dr. Leroy Birney, whether we are, at the present time, well prepared for the threat of an epidemic.
One probably never is as well prepared as one would like to be, but I believe that we are better prepared to meet this possibility of an epidemic of influenza than we have ever been prepared to meet any other serious health problem in the past.
CBS Radio has presented a special documentary program about the threatened epidemic of Asian flu and the defense against it. Our narrator was CBS News correspondent Walter Cronkite. This program was produced by George Vikas, written by Bill Geib. This is a CBS Public Affairs program.